Well, as I said this morning, the advanced planning of this committee is what brought me here. And when I heard the title for a possible talk, Assurance, Not Insurance, that's the one that really pushed me over the edge. I thought it was such a wonderful topic for discussion because it challenges thought. Assurance, not insurance. The relationships of the words, which sound so similar, but in fact are diametrically opposite. So I was challenged myself in trying to define the difference between assurance and insurance. I realized, as we all do, that assurance is based on understanding, and insurance is based on fear. Assurance is that quality of thought that is fearless, that is, it comes from our radical reliance on the promises in the Bible and in the Christian Science textbook. And we love those promises. They're wonderful, and they assure us that God is ever present, that God is the most incredible love that our human thought can possibly comprehend, and even more. That this love is like a caring parent, wise, intelligent, gentle, and beneficent. That this love is ever available to meet every human need. So then we look at what is our need. The metaphysics of Christian Science teach that we don't ever need things. We never need matter. We never need money. Always our need is for greater understanding of the eternal fact that man already has all he will ever need. There's nothing out there that man needs to get, but rather man's need is always to understand better, I have. Another way of saying it is that the real man is not at the standpoint of I want, but always at the standpoint of I have. Insurance, on the other hand, comes out of the fear that we won't have enough, out of the fear that something catastrophic can happen to us, and then we'll find all our resources depleted, and so we must have to have some kind of written agreement between us and some business, a plan of some kind, a contingency, to meet the unexpected devastation which could possibly happen to us. I received a telephone call several weeks ago soliciting my purchase of health insurance. I was trying politely but firmly to terminate the call quickly, convincing the solicitor I wasn't interested, and she immediately came back, "But what if?" And when I tried to stop that, there was another, "What if? What if this happened? What if that happened?" And when I would interrupt her, she said, "But you know," and she started rattling off statistics to back up her assertion that these things could very well happen to me. Well, I did terminate the conversation, but I couldn't stop thinking about it, knowing that I was participating in this conference. And the more I thought about that phrase, "what if," the phrase that they use to engender fear, to engender a reliance on material means, I found myself just rejoicing in the other "what if." What if all the promises, all of the assurances in the Bible and Mrs. Eddy's writings are true? What if man really is the child of God, really is loved and cared for, watched over and protected? What if all of this is true? If it is true, then there's no need for the insurance plan at high dollar cost that's always being offered. Assurance, not insurance. There's wonderful assurance in Jesus' discussion in the Sermon on the Mount about provision. Jesus assures us that the God who clothes the grass of the field, who provides for the lily which never has to toil or spin, the fowls of the air who do not have to plant and harvest, and he encourages us to serve the one master and trust God implicitly. Radical statements like taking no thought for tomorrow, tomorrow shall take care of itself. Within this discussion, we find Jesus' powerful imperative. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. Within the kingdom of heaven and God's righteousness is every right idea that is the supply for every human need that we'll ever have. And we find that only within the kingdom of heaven. If we think we're going to find our assurance, our security, our safety, our supply, or our health in the things of matter, they will always be just outside of reach. But as we seek the understanding of what the kingdom of heaven means, all these things will be added and in fact are at hand. They will be there by way of demonstration. Mortal mind would like to trick us into thinking that we need to seek what we need in matter. But this whole discussion of supply starts out with Jesus' instructions, "Ye cannot serve God and mammon." Mrs. Eddy adds to this discussion in the little article I referred to this morning. It's one of my favorites, the little one entitled Angel. In this article, she uses the word sweet assurance. She underscores Jesus' teachings with, "Never ask for tomorrow. It is enough that divine love is an ever-present help. And if you wait, never doubting, you will have all you need every moment." This is still her words. What a glorious inheritance is given to us through the understanding of omnipresent love. More we cannot ask, more we do not want, more we cannot have. And then she says, "This sweet assurance is the peace be still to all human fears, to suffering of every sort." And it really says it all. This is the sweet assurance we have, our understanding of God and His care for us. In another place, Mrs. Eddy, in considering the assurance that we get from the Bible, tells us, in Genesis we read that God gave man dominion over all things, and this assurance is followed by Jesus' declaration, "All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth," and by His promise that the Christ-like shall finally sit down at the right hand of the Father. That's a miscellaneous writing. Again, she tells us that the confidence inspired by science lies in the fact that truth is real and error is unreal. Now, the confidence that naturally follows our acceptance of the promises and the assurances in the Bible and her writings, she summarizes, lies in the fact that truth is real and error is unreal. Now, to me, this seems to give us the key to the difference between assurance and insurance. Insurance depends on what if. Assurance, then, depends on what is. And the challenge before each of us is where to place our thinking. What foundation are we going to choose to determine our actions? The what if in human planning or the what is of spiritual understanding? So it comes down to a matter of trust. Where do we put our reliance? It comes back to one of the simplest teachings of Christian Science. It's so simple that our little children, our preschoolers, can understand this statement and follow it. And yet it is so profound that some of the most advanced students of Christian Science fail to see its utter importance and follow it fully. And this is a statement, and you all know it by heart. Stand quarter at the door of thought, admitting only such conclusions as you wish realized in bodily results, you will control yourself harmoniously. Now that's very easy to understand. It's very plain. The little children can visualize standing at the door of something and keeping out the wrong thing. Mrs. Eddy tells us why we have to stand for it, because what we admit is what we will realize in our own experience. It's an easy thing to state, but I have tried, and it's a wonderful little exercise to do, to watch your thinking for 1 hour and see how many times we admit to something we really wouldn't like in our experience. Insurance is based upon our letting pass by that door of thought things we wouldn't like realized in our own experience. That someday we could have a terrible accident. That someday we could have an unhealed physical problem. And because of that, someday we'll be old and vulnerable. Someday we're going to need an agreement whereby we pay a certain amount of money every month in order to cover the possibility of these things happening. So if we just let all of that into the body of consciousness, once it's in the body of consciousness, it is in our experience. There's no difference between consciousness and experience. So the question is always, what are we admitting? And the answer is, only those conclusions we really wish realized in our own experience. Someone can ask, but I have a friend who did experience a devastating loss. Or I know someone who did experience catastrophic illness. Now, if we even admit into the body of consciousness that our friend or acquaintance really did have that happening to them, we've let it in and it's now ours. We have to realize that our friends may have experienced a bad dream, even a nightmare of sickness and loss, but it is their dream. This doesn't excuse us from being helpful and caring, but we don't let it in as reality. The other what ifs that we need to keep before us constantly. What if Christian Science heals quickly? What if Christian Science heals permanently? What if truth is prophylactic, preventative, as well as therapeutic, healing? What if we stand quarter at the door and refuse to admit a single thought that gives any reality to sin, sickness, lack, loss, matter, to age, to time, or to money? What if we exercise this God-given ability to resist all that is unlike good, as Mrs. Eddy directs? When we discuss supply and healing and money and matter and disease and incurability or unhealed problems, we so often think of age, and that was mentioned this morning, and this is something very close to our thoughts. It is so important that each of us stand quarter at the door of thought when it comes to suggestions of age. It's so interesting when we're in the practice, and if somebody calls about a child who has fallen, there is such expectancy of quick healing. But if somebody calls about a parent or a grandparent or an elderly friend who has fallen, there is a great deal of fear and almost an unspoken fear of perhaps permanent disability. And you can't help but notice that when you're in the practice. And we know what's behind this. It's the belief that there's young matter and old matter. That young bones heal quickly and old bones heal slowly or maybe not at all. If our beloved leader could say about matter that it's sometimes beautiful and always erroneous, could we not also say matter sometimes young, sometimes old, but always erroneous? What do we expect? What do we let slide by the quarter of thought regarding our expectancies and regarding the suggestions of age? My grandmother lived with me and became a student of Christian Science in her 70s. At the time, I was living in a house that was over 100 years old and had very high ceilings, so the stairways were very tall, and this one had two different landings on it. And my grandmother fell from the top of the stairs, tumbling all the way down to the bottom, and I witnessed it. Now, in my background, as I said, I have medical experience, and I had worked for several years in a general practitioner's office, and I could tell by the way she was crumpled at the bottom of the stairs that there were broken bones, and the contusions, the bruises were obvious. But without any medical attention at all, she was completely healed and attended church with me on Thanksgiving less than 6 weeks after the fall, walking with the cane that she had been using for several years, and it seemed to be a security thing for her. This same dear one later experienced a healing of arthritis of some 20 years standing through her own work, and this to me is so remarkable because she had third grade education. Many of the words in the textbook she couldn't pronounce, let alone understand. But she had lived with me when the children were small, and she had often heard me explaining to them
instructions of how to deal with various problems, and we discuss the lesson. And she picks up some very childlike, not childish, but childlike approaches to her prayers. One of the things that I taught the children that when they encounter a hurt or a burn or a pinch or a bump or a sting, they come running and say, "Mama, I've got some unreality." And because I wanted them early on to classify it correctly, they didn't say, "Oh," they get hurt and they, "Oh, unreality." And so grandmother picked up on this, and she was soon classifying anything that was painful or any symptoms of any kind. She'd come to me and say, "Will you help me? I have some unreality." And so she started learning how to stand quarter at the door of thought. Another phrase that the little children would sometimes use, because I would read over to them the discussion, that wonderful discussion from 390 to 394, which includes this statement, "Stand quarter at the door of thought." And they learned to talk back to error, and they coined the phrase, "Get out of here, old error." And they speak right to it, and they say, "Get out of here, I'm not going to listen to you, old error." And she picked up on that with the same sweet innocency. It came from Jesus' teaching, "Get thee behind me, Satan," but they did it in the language that meant something to them. Well, after my mother passed, I was the only one, except grandmother and my family, to be Christian Scientists. My grandmother left to stay with me and left to live with my dad to keep health for him. And I had to see her for several months, and she had this arthritic problem for, let's say, over 20 years. She hadn't been able to bend, get in and out of a tub. She hadn't been able to do a lot of the gardening that she loved doing. And when my husband Dick and I got there late in the afternoon, she had just finished spading, turning the dirt over, for a huge flower bed, probably 35 feet long and 6 feet wide. She was joyous, and I could just tell by looking at her, she was doing fine. She said she was wonderful, and she told me earlier that day she had scrubbed the kitchen floor on her hands and knees, and she washed all the windows in that three-bedroom house on the inside before she spaded the garden. And I said, "Grandma, you were down on your hands and knees," and she was a giggler, and she giggled and said, "Yes, I had my feeling. I'll tell you about it later." So when we were doing dishes that night together, too bad we don't do dishes with our children anymore. We really missed a wonderful thing. But Grandma and I were doing dishes together, and I said, "Tell me about your healing." And she said, "Well, every time I went to bend or stretch and I couldn't, my body wouldn't bend or it wouldn't move," she said, "I just told it, 'Get out of here, old error. You're no part of God and you're no part of me.'" I said, "Yes, and what else?" "No, that was it." And I said, "How long have you been doing this?" And she said, "Oh, since Christmas. It was after Christmas I started." And I said, how often did you do it?" She said, "Every time. Every time I would want to bend or reach and couldn't do it, I said, 'Get out of here, old error. You're no part of God. You're no part of me.'" Now, when you analyze that simple prayer, it is so absolute. It identifies God is perfect and man is perfect, and the suggestion as suggestion and not as condition. And she saw that, classifying it, standing quarter at the door, thought every time, and she had her healing. What if God is all and man is his image and likeness? There was such persistence in that simple prayer, and you can't help thinking of Mrs. Eddy telling us, persistence alone wins the prize. Her childlike conviction coupled with her persistence won the prize. Healed of a condition that had been in existence for over 20 years, and she was close to 80 at that time. Age is not a power. It presents itself as a problem, but it is never a power. It doesn't matter what somebody else's dream or temptation or belief or suggestion has been. We stand quarter at the door of our own thought and govern our own experience. In discussing age, it's always helpful to remember that the belief of age has to do with the belief of accumulation. The accumulation of unhandled false beliefs, undisciplined thinking, of beliefs about past hurts, unhappinesses, injustices, disappointments, pains, and so forth. And in order to address the aggressiveness of the belief of age, one must stand quarter at the door, thought, and admit only those conclusions that have to do with this moment. Now, the beloved disciple wrote, are we the sons of God? The only moment we can ever live is now. And there is no history to this moment of now. There is no yesterday. There is no tomorrow. There's only now. If we begin to understand more clearly that there is no passage of time, that there is only the unfolding of right events, right activity, and right time, we can break free to a great extent from the so-called expectance of the ravages of time. There is no such thing as an old man or a young man. One of the things I like to do in class is I ask them, how do you demonstrate youth? And I just see them thinking of all the ways they can demonstrate youth. And of course, we know the answer is that we don't demonstrate youth. We demonstrate agelessness. There is no youth and there is no age. Man is eternally held in the image and likeness of God. And when any suggestion of age and of the past knocks at the door of thought, it really is the suggestion of time. If we're going to overcome the beliefs of age, we have to stay close to that childlike thought, the innocency, and how the child lives only in the moment. I marvel at what we learn from our little ones. We see them in a terrible fight with their playmate. Maybe they just hit each other over the head with a Tonka truck, and there's lots of pain and lots of hurt and lots of anger. And they say, "Well, I'm never going to play with you again. I'm never going to see Billy again. I don't like Billy." And they go down for their nap, and they have an hour, hour and a half of sweet sleep, and they wake up and say, "Can I go over to Billy?" It's all gone. They don't cling to the injustices and the pains and the hurt. It's over. And if we can have more of that in our experience and watch for any hanging on to the resentments and the mistakes and the memories of wrongdoing, we'll do a lot to overcome the age belief. Here's another what if. What if there should be a human need? Isn't divine love able to meet it? Won't God send his angel messages to us and others at that point? Won't this unlimited expression of love that is in the heart of each one of God's children meet that need? Won't it find its way into our experience to bless and to be sufficient for every need? And what if we have a friend, a church member, or several friends come forward and say to us, "Let us help you." Will we have the humility to accept that? There is so much talk today about catastrophic illness, which by definition, according to Webster, means a momentous, tragic event ranging from extreme misfortune to utter overthrow or ruin. Catastrophic illness. What is it? Does it mean some diseases are more dangerous or more difficult or more devastating than others? Probably everyone in this room has seen instances of the so-called incurable or terminal illness healed in Christian Science. These things are supposed to be catastrophic. They're supposed to lead to our complete physical or financial ruin, but we've seen them healed. And if we've seen it once, it's within the realm of possibility in our firsthand experience. And this is where our thought needs to be. There is no such thing as an incurable disease if we can keep remembering that we're always dealing with a suggestion, not a condition. In our talk this morning, we talked about man's need to give, the need for each individual for his own sense of financial and physical well-being, to be at the standpoint of giving rather than at the standpoint of wanting. We know how important that is. We must always be willing to give, but we need to look at the other side of it. As we address the need this afternoon for greater assurance rather than more insurance, we need to plant ourselves on the expectancy of each and every promise of God.
Many of the promises in the Bible and the Christian Science textbook have conditions attached, just as insurance plans are full of contingencies, provisions, and conditions that must be fulfilled. Surely when we're faced with an illness that isn't yielding, there is always the need for that which I term the need to be excruciatingly honest with oneself and then with the practitioner. We must be willing to look courageously at our own patterns of thinking, to discern and detect those negative or erroneous thought patterns that have been slipping by at the door of thought. The willingness to take up the study of anatomy, as Mrs. Eddy outlines it in Christian Science. The anatomy of Christian Science teaches when and how to probe the self-inflicted wounds of selfishness, malice, envy, and hate. It teaches the control of mad ambition, to be willing to examine thought instead of looking at the body. She instructs us to probe the self-inflicted wounds of selfishness, and you know what it means to probe a wound. It hurts. It hurts bad when we probe a wound. It hurts like the dickens. And she tells us that in Christian Science, the study of anatomy insists that we are willing to probe these self-inflicted wounds. She tells us of what? Selfishness, malice, envy, and hate. Not a comfortable thing to do. Not easy. But there is no assurance whatsoever in the teachings of Christian Science that ever tell us it's going to be easy. I've looked. I've looked and I've looked. There is the assurance that we can do it, even when it's not easy, if we faithfully follow her teaching. Christian Science never fails, but sometimes we fail to follow as fully as possible her teaching. It's surely not comfortable to look hard at our own false character traits that are so unlike God, but when we are willing, we can find ourselves healed. She continues in that same discussion. If the study of anatomy in Christian Science teaches the control of mad ambition, and then she says, it unfolds the hallowed influences of unselfishness, philanthropy, spiritual love. That's another word for benevolence, philanthropy. It finds its roots in the Greek word love, philo, brotherly love, and it means by definition goodwill to fellow men, an active effort to promote human welfare. That's why we're here today, to think of benevolence, philanthropy that comes out of a desire to help our fellow man through the teachings of Christian Science, through the understanding better of that divine love that meets every human need. There really is no dearer or sweeter assurance than that. As I was praying about this discussion and listening for what God might speak to us that could be helpful, a suggestion came that maybe has merit. For those who are struggling with the issue of whether or not to have insurance, whether or not to invest in insurance plans, I'd like to suggest that we invest in the assurance plan. Why not take a paperback Science and Health and a highlighter pen and read through it again from cover to cover, highlighting every statement of assurance, so that when you find fear knocking at the portal of thought, we can take this Science and Health of the medicine that is mine, that assures us that with God, all things are possible. And then why not do the same with the concordance and highlight those assurances in the Bible, highlighting everyone we find, and so we will be so filled with the conviction of what is, that we will have a spiritual insurance that we will never be put in a position where love has not gone before us and is not awaiting its tender lesson for us and its abundant blessing for us. Assurance and spiritual insurance. Thank you.